When you're sad and when you're lonely, and you haven't got a friend, just remember that death is not the end.
And all that you held sacred falls down and does not mend. Just remember that death is not the end.
Not the end. Not the end. Just remember that death is not the end.
As the old saying goes, death will always be with us. But as final as it seems, defining death is not always easy to do, as witnessed by the case of Nancy Crozan. William Colby has written a book on Crozan's death and the issues it raised. He speaks with Drew Burgesson, professor of history at the University of Missouri, Kansas City.
Death has always been a part of human history, but in recent decades, the boundary between life and death has blurred in physiological, legal, and ethical terms. Today, I have the pleasure of trying to reconstruct that history in part with William H. Colby, a fellow of the Midwest Bioethics Center in Kansas City and the advocate for the family of Nancy Crozan in the first right-to-die case ever heard by the United States Supreme Court. His book, Long Goodbye, The Deaths of Nancy Crozan, was published by Hay House in 2002. Bill, welcome to Talking History.
Thank you very much, Drew.
You have spoken in many venues about the Crozan case from a legal and ethical standpoint. I wonder if you might explore the topic for our listeners from an historical perspective. Let's start with technology. When and how did medical science blur the boundary between life and death?
That's a big question. And we're on a show that's talking about history. So in terms of history, it's extremely recent. Just take people back to the 1960s. Many listeners will remember the Dr. Kildare show.
Right.
Dr. Kildare, when things got very dark, when it looked like there was no other option, would often say, "Go get me the bird." He was talking about something called a bird respirator, invented by a man named Forrest Bird in California in the late 50s, started to be used in the 60s. One of his respirators, early ones, didn't have an automatic switch. So a doctor or a nurse would have to sit with a machine and flip a switch 12 times a minute to shoot a blast of air into the body. Huh. Those patients on Dr. Kildare's show sometimes survived. In the real world, they often survived only a day or two, regained their ability to breathe on their own, or died.
Right.
So it's just been the 60s and the 70s when technology has advanced to the point that it's made these decisions now a matter of technology and not nature necessarily.
So it seems in your book that since the 1970s, you're arguing that we've literally seen the emergence of a new class of human beings, neither fully deceased nor fully living. How did this new class of patients challenge the practice of medicine?
Well, the technology has raised some fundamental questions about what the goal of medicine is, how we use technology, and when we say it's not serving the ends that we sought to have it serve.
Mm-hmm. How does this new class of patients challenge the law? You're a lawyer.
I am. But as you can tell from the book, the law certainly has no special wisdom in this area. And most judges I've talked with who have had to decide a right-to-die case have said they wished it would have landed somewhere other than their courtroom or their courthouse. One way that the law has dealt with the question is the whole issue of defining death. Many states passed new laws. Missouri's was in 1982. That's reflective of many other states, defining death in a new way, the so-called now brain death, where the traditional way we thought of death, the heart and lung stopping,
right,
didn't always necessarily answer the questions when technology was involved. Many states passed living will laws. We've had the laws tried to keep up to deal with the ethical questions, but it's not the special province of the law by any stretch.
And there's also a question of which part of the brain is dead. Because you could have one part of the brain not functioning and the other one not part functioning.
The upper or thinking part of the brain can go a much shorter time without oxygen and it's damaged, as opposed to the lower part, the brain stem, basically. That's not exactly technically right, but for our purposes. So the brain stem, that part which controls our primitive reflexes, can go a long time without oxygen and survive. The thinking part of the brain can't.
So you could have a situation where someone gets in a car accident, for instance, and the upper part of their brain, the thinking part of their brain, does not get enough oxygen, dies in effect, but the rest of the brain gets resuscitated by medical intervention.
Which, that's exactly what happened in the Cruzan case.
Right. What are some of the political stakes in this debate?
Well, I think in many ways, both going back, but certainly going forward, the stakes are huge. Mm-hmm. We have, depending on who you listen to, but Census Bureau says before too long, we're going to have close to 80 million of us baby boomers, 65 years old and older, over 20% of the population. Those boomers are going to have available to them technologies that we can't even dream of today. God knows what the funding will be at that point. And the boomers are a group of people who have always demanded things. So and there'll be a huge voting block. The questions about how to use this technology, when to use it, we're just at the tip of the iceberg right now.
I'm a German historian, so I'd like to ask you a slightly off-topic question. Many scholars tend to trace the origins of the Holocaust to the Nazi policies of euthanizing the handicapped. Nazi eugenicists called them Lebensunwürdiges Leben, or life unworthy of life. Can you describe how the memory of Nazi euthanasia affects this debate?
Let me answer that a couple of different ways. The first, I think, looking at the modern question of, in Nancy Cruzan's situation, someone in a car accident stopping medical treatment when it has not served as a bridge to recovery, that decision to stop medical treatment that hasn't worked, and the decision to administer a lethal dose to hasten death, which we hear talked about today as euthanasia. I think between those two situations, there's a huge chasm. I just find them as fundamentally different decisions on moral, ethical, legal, many, many grounds. But then step back from that to the time you're talking about, when in Nazi Germany, people were secreted away from their homes under false pretenses and then euthanized or murdered, and not as the result of any kind of family decision, which we have involved in these cases today, but from the state acting. I find them as really very different questions. Although, as that, what's the cliche of history? Those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. So we need to be mindful of the value of life and valuing life. But I think it was a fundamentally different time.
Tell us a little bit more about Nancy Cruzan, kind of the details of her case.
People who have read Long Goodbye have said to me that one of the things that strikes them is the universality of the story, that it can happen anytime to anyone. Joe Cruzan often said life can turn on a dime. And as a parent, you think about that phone call in the night from the state trooper that many parents have gotten that changes everything forever for that family.
Right.
For the Cruzans, Nancy was in a single car accident. She was 25 at the time, thrown from the car. As we reconstructed the story later, she went a significant period of time. It was a deserted country road before anyone arrived. May have been as long as 30 minutes. By the time they arrived that night, again, it, just as you asked, everything that made her uniquely human was gone from her brain and was never coming back. Family didn't know any of that. Their hope faded over time. Their knowledge about the power of anoxia or lack of oxygen came over time. And they came to a point several years later when they realized they had two basic choices: leave their daughter in a state facility, unaware of the world around her, without hope of regaining that awareness. Doctor said she could live 30 years. One bad choice. The other bad choice, to seek removal of the only technology keeping her alive, a feeding tube, and have that hand in the death of their daughter. They really had no good choices left.
Right. And one of the one of the key decisions, I remember the section in the book where you were talking, describing the nurses who were very reluctant to pull the tube out because they felt that that was equivalent to what we were just discussing a moment ago about the Nazis, that that was an overt act that was intervening in the body. And by taking some overt act to hurt someone, that was slipping over that fine line between allowing someone to die and actually taking that life.
It's something that's written a lot in the medical literature that doesn't translate, at least in my experience, directly to the practice, is that initially withholding and later withdrawing medical treatment should be the same ethical standard. In fact, you should be more willing to initially try a treatment than if it doesn't serve the purpose for which you put it in place. You've at least tried for recovery, then stop that
treatment. Right, because the alternative would be that if then I would not want to try something because I would never be able to pull it out.
Exactly right. And the other side of that alternative is to say to the parents 3 weeks after the accident, we don't think there's much chance of recovery, but there's maybe a slim one. But if you say yes to this surgery today to insert this tube into your daughter who's lost the natural ability to swallow, then you forever forfeit your right to undo that permission. That puts parents in a horrible conundrum, which you'd never want to.
I was particularly struck when I read your book by the way that the Cruzan family treated Nancy as if she was both dead and alive at the same time, as if she was almost in two different kinds of states at the same time.
One of the counselors for the family said at the time, they're faced with a situation where they go to visit her twice a week, 90 miles from their home. They know she has no awareness of the world around her. So that each week, two times, that grief is reopened all over again. They're not allowed closure. They're not allowed moving on. But their loved one's still there in some capacity too. So it's not only that the horrible thing of having a child in such a profound accident, but then the long period of time in that kind of limbo where you're exactly right. They came into the room, they talked with her all the while knowing she had no idea that they were there.
Or like when they celebrated Christmas and they were celebrating with her on the one hand, and yet they knew that she wasn't there at the same time. What a strange circumstance. You lost your case in the Supreme Court. So how did you win for Nancy the right to die?
People have the perception of the Supreme Court, or any court really, that you hear a case and you get an answer one way or another. Often the reality is a little bit more complicated than that. U.S. Supreme Court has 9 justices. Each can write their own opinion. In our case, 5 of the 9 wrote separate rulings on the Cruzan case. New York Times headline the next day said something to the effect, Cruzan's or new constitutional right found by Supreme Court. St. Louis Post-Dispatch said court rules against Cruzan's. There was something for everyone in there. The court did say for the first time that all of us, conscious, competent people, have a federal constitutional right to refuse medical treatment. But it allowed states to have procedures in place as to how that right is executed for people who could no longer speak. It did say that new evidence can surface, so you could have a second trial, perhaps. That's what happened in our case. As a result of all of the publicity, people had come forward, so we had a second trial with the new witnesses.
And in the second trial, the state of Missouri decided not to fight with the same vehemence, and the result was that you were able to get approval to remove the tube from Nancy.
In the second trial, we only had the lawyer appointed by the court opposing us, as opposed to the lawyer appointed by the court and the state. And the state said at the time, the attorney general said at the time, we now know what the standard is, therefore we, the state, will not be involved any longer.
What other kind of landmark cases have followed since then?
That's really the only case that the U.S. Supreme Court has dealt with. There have been other state court cases. These issues continue to come up. There was the Finn case in Virginia, the Wendland case in California, going on right now, the Schiavo case in Florida. So the issues don't stop, and they won't.
So what kind of advice would you give to our listeners, regardless of their position on the issue of the right to die, to protect themselves and their family in this brave new world of, in which death and life are no longer self-evident categories?
I guess a couple of things. People hear about something called a living will all the time.
Right.
A living will is a document where I would say, if I'm in certain conditions, if I have Alzheimer's, I don't want, and then you list the treatments, respirator, feeding tube, whatever it might be. I think those documents have some value. To me, the much more useful document and something that's easy for people to execute is a document that says, name someone to decide if you can't. It's called a durable power of attorney for healthcare, healthcare proxy. If I'm incapacitated, here's who decides. But that's just the start. Research is very clear that either of those documents by themselves are not enough. You then need to talk with that person you've given the power to about your views, about your values, so that when the time comes of making those hard decisions, they're empowered to act as an advocate on your behalf, because it's never black and white at that moment. It's always gray. There are always hard decisions, and you need someone who knows what you want and who can act on your behalf.
Yeah, in the Nancy Cruzan case, the case in the end rested on whether or not she had explicitly said to other people that she would not want to be in a persistent vegetative state.
Maybe in part it rested on that, mm-hmm. but I don't know how important the law is in this area. People are born, people die every day. Decisions have to be made. And in the Cruzan case, I think to a great extent, it turned on what the case did was to raise the consciousness of the country, to get people talking about their views and values. It was in the news for so many years, and we had so much discussion within our state about the topic, that we finally came to the point as a state saying we should allow the family to make this decision.
Great. Thank you very much. My guest today has been William H. Colby, lawyer, bioethicist, and author. His book, Long Goodbye, The Deaths of Nancy Cruzan, published by Hay House in 2002, is not so much a story of lives lived, what historians would understand as a biography, but of death lived, a necrography.
When you're sad and when you're lonely, and you haven't got a friend, just remember that death is not the end.
And all that you held sacred falls down and does not mend.